and Transportation to order. And I would like to welcome everyone here and say happy Oregon State University Day. My goodness, I've never seen so much black and orange in my life, and I hope that the Oregon State people have enjoyed their day. There are a number of alumni, and I don't know how many of you actually went to Oregon State, but I know former Senator Messerly did, and so I'm sure he's had a good time in the Capitol today. Our children went to Oregon State, and we're big Beaver fans, but we're big Duck fans every time they don't play the Beavers. We're big Duck fans. So I've been waiting, and sorry to delay the committee, but we're a little bit slow around the building. Committee meetings are running longer. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to open the public hearing part on SJM 7. And ask those that are to witness to come forward to the table, and then if I may close the public hearing, so please don't leave the room, and I'll move on to another public hearing because I cannot go into work session until I have a quorum. So I'm going to open the public hearing on SJM 7, and I'll ask Don Mann, the general manager from the Port of Newport in my district, to come forward.
Thank you, Senator, and Senator Whitsitt. For the record, my name is Don Mann. I'm the general manager of the Port of Newport, and I thank you for this opportunity. And I preface my remarks by reminding the Senator a little over a month ago, you asked, what would I do if I was king for the day for ports? And the supporting federal funding for dredging was one of those issues that was important. Therefore, with the draft of this resolution and your support, we thank you. I'd like to begin by saying that the Oregon Congressional delegation has been unified in pursuing dredging funds for the Oregon ports. Senator Wyden, Smith, Congresswoman Hooley, Peter DeFazio, Greg Walden, David Wu have been fearless in their efforts to support this issue, and I don't want to indicate that they're not doing a great job for us. It's just that we need to put more pressure on the federal administration to gain more funding for dredging. Second, in view of the discussions taking place regarding the role of the state in supporting ports, I ask for the state's support for ports generally, with the continued shrinking federal budget for dredging and other needs. We've witnessed this over about the last 25 years, and there's no signs of it changing. For this reason, many state governments are stepping in and increasing their support of their ports because they know how important ports are to the state economies and their local communities. We, the Oregon ports, appreciate the commitment of the legislature to maintain our public ports as this state involvement is becoming more essential each year. Under relenting pressure from the White House Office of Management and Budget, the Corps of Engineers budget has shrunk continuously, as I mentioned earlier. And for the past 25 years, OMB has forced the Corps of Engineers, to reduce spending on navigation projects, both new construction and maintenance of existing projects. At the same time, environmental organizations and the press have criticized some of the Corps project as pork barrel, wasteful, and unnecessary damaging to the environment. This scrutiny, combined with budget pressures and increased OMB oversight, have led to new self-discipline at the Corps. First, the Corps began to apply cost-benefit analysis to its projects, both proposed projects being studied, such as the channel deepening project on the Columbia, and existing projects, such as the maintenance and dredging of existing channels. More recently, the Corps has instituted another mechanism to help prioritize projects and to determine which would be funded and which would not. These new mechanisms are called performance metrics. Oregon ports were represented by the state's federal lobbyists at the Corps' recent two-day performance metrics workshop. Because the Corps is in the midst of defining the concept and the terms of its application to projects, basically performance metrics, or performance measures, you may have heard them called, is to be a formula for measuring each project against national objectives. The Corps is still attempting to define these national objectives and determine how to apply them to the many projects around the country. Considering the diversity of navigation projects, this is proving to be a difficult task. And what would be the national objectives? Moving commercial cargo, stimulating exports, economic development of rural areas, flood control, environmental impacts. How can one set of objectives possibly apply to a load center containing a megaport like Los Angeles, a medium-sized industrial bulk port like Coos Bay, a large commercial fishing port like Newport, and a Columbia River port such as the port of Morrow upriver? In sum, it is very clear that the Corps is still under severe budget pressure to reduce overall budget spending and to prioritize among projects, grapple with the task of determining appropriate national objectives for navigation projects, determine how to apply national objectives to diverse projects, and how to impose discipline on each of the Corps' districts to apply the performance metrics in the same way. In my view, as the manager of the Port of Newport, this uncertainty of federal support for ports leads me to reiterate to this committee today the importance of your efforts here in Salem to assure the continued vitality of all Oregon ports. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions you may have. And thanks again for your support, Senator.
Thank you very much, Don. I really am happy that you were so cooperative and welcome to come by, back and be juggled around on our agendas. One of the things that bothers me, and I'm very supportive of this memorial, but I sometimes worry about what happens to these when they get to Washington, D.C., that somebody says, oh, another memorial. And so I think that, do you have any ideas of ways that we might strengthen the memorials that we send?
Senator Berger, I believe in the case of this particular memorial, we have enough support from our congressional delegation that they're going to be very pleased to receive this memorial, so they know that the state is supporting all ports in Oregon, and not only sends a message from Oregon, it sends a message from around the nation, and we're hoping that other states will do the same thing, because, as I mentioned in my testimony, our delegation has been fearless. They have not given up. Every year that we get cut out of the budget, they put us back in. And one more tool of support does not hurt at all, and they will take it serious.
Well, of course, I'm biased, but I think it's a shame that we have to go every cycle with our hand out begging for funds that are so important to our state and other ports around the country. It isn't just Oregon. And I don't know why we have to kind of be down in the food chain in that way, but until we make it very, very clear about the economic impact, I also kind of think sometimes that we need to look at things, what if we didn't have them? I think about Coos Bay and what if we didn't have the international port of Coos Bay there. We've lost, as you know, a number of ships that are coming in, but still in all, we still have a viable port. We still have a wonderful future. I think that Mike Gall and Martin Callery are here with us today from the Port of Coos Bay, and I appreciate their being in the audience. But and certainly, I've gained ports as my district grew. I've gained some more ports, and so and I'm very, very interested in small ports. So I appreciate your testimony today, and I'll open it to any questions that you may have. Senator Whitsett, do you have any questions? Senator Starr, this is Don Mann from the Port of Newport, as you
Senator
probably
Member.
Know.
Absolutely.
And we are addressing Senate Joint Memorial 7.
Yep.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to open a work session on SJM 7.
Madam Chair, I move SJM 7 to the floor within a be adopted recommendation.
All right. Senator Whitsett moves Senate SJM 7 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Metzger. Krasowski. Starr.
Aye.
Whitsett.
Aye.
Chair Berger.
Aye. The motion having received the majority that's needed to declare passed. And I'll close the work session on SJM Memorial. And with the committee's indulgence, I would like to carry the bill. Next, we'll take up Senate Bill 961. I'll open the public hearing. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 961 creates a task force on maritime pilotage. It appropriates monies from the general fund to the Department of Transportation for the task force. For that reason, it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The measure would declare an emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Judith. I'll call Pat Egan and Jeff Krug from the Port Department. Krug.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and members of the
committee. Good afternoon. Welcome.
For the record, my name is Pat Egan with the Port of Portland, and I'd like to say, first of all, it's a very good day. It's a good day to be a Beaver, which I are one. Jeff's, I think, just about to send somebody to OSU. I also want to thank you for both the bill that you just considered and moved out, certainly something we're very supportive of, major issue for us. We do a lot of work with the Oregon Ports Group and the Pacific Northwest Waterways Association in carrying that message forward, and couldn't agree with you more on memorials. It's really in the follow-through, I think, and I think what if you pass that will give us a tool to carry forward with our discussions with the congressional delegation and league with other ports in the state of Oregon. So thank you very much for that.
And you know how much that I encourage the Port of Portland to be very, very considerate of all these small ports.
Madam Chair, you have been absolutely consistent and clear in the matter, and we take it seriously. Last thing I'll say before I get into 961 is I think it's also a very good day that you're taking up Senate Bill 71, and thank you very much for your leadership in moving that forward, and we want to do everything we can to be supportive as it moves forward. So thank you again. Senate Bill 961 is a bill that you were good enough, Madam Chair, to help us in introducing. This is an issue around pilotage that I must admit, having been around transportation issues for a good portion of my adult life, pilotage is not one of the things that's been high on my radar screen, and I would suspect, I'd venture to say, it may not have been terribly high on some of the committee members. It's a relatively arcane issue, not terribly well understood, but we believe has a major impact on Oregon's economy, certainly on marine commerce, and all of the goods and shippers that deal with marine commerce, and I think even beyond that. Senate Bill 961, I think, is an attempt, and I'll put it in those terms, an attempt to look and take a serious look at this issue that is relatively arcane, and to shine a little light on it outside of the confines of a rate hearing. And a rate hearing, and Jeff Krug here is going to give you a little bit of his own background and experience in dealing with the Board of Maritime Pilots, which sets the rate for the three various forms of pilots in the state of Oregon. But a rate hearing is not necessarily a good place to really take a look and parse out some of the costs, transportation costs, compensation costs, and to take a nice objective look at those and say, what is the effect on Oregon's economy? That's what we see Senate Bill 961 as being. And so with your indulgence, I've given you, the committee, a little bit of background on some of the costs and some of the issues that we see. As I've mentioned to this committee before, we see ourselves very much in competition with ports up and down the West Coast, particularly with the ports in Puget Sound and the ports in Southern California. I've cited some figures in here that we've also submitted as testimony in rate cases before the Board of Maritime Pilots, that, for example, pilot costs to get a container vessel on average run about a little over $7,000 to get into the Port of Tacoma. Today it's a little over $24,000 to get the same type of vessel into the Port of Portland. To be fair, there are good reasons for some of this. It's a longer transit. There are two separate pilotage grounds. The bar at the Columbia River Bar is a very dangerous one, known worldwide for being so. And so we want well-trained, safe pilots, and I want to make that absolutely clear for the committee and for everyone who's paying attention to this, that this is not about lessening the standards. This is not about lessening the qualifications. This is about, we see, a serious issue and the costs associated with it. One of the things, again, I've talked to this committee about is container service, and we see that as a major benefit, what we provide to the region in lowered shipping costs, avoiding the cost of draying or railing the containers up to the Port of Tacoma or down to a California port. And we've been very active since we've lost some major container service over the last year in trying to recruit container service. And Jeff can tell you a little bit about this, but the differential between the Port of Portland and the Port of Tacoma or the Port of Seattle is almost $1 million in pilotage costs on an annual basis for weekly service. That 7,000 versus 24,000 figure, if you run that out, is nearly $1 million. Very significant impact, and something that is raised every time we talk with container service providers, steamship companies. Now, is it the only factor? Absolutely not. Is this pilotage cost the one and only reason why the Port of Portland doesn't have more container service? I'm not going to tell this committee or anybody else that is the only factor. Is it a primary factor? Absolutely, along with many others. That's why we believe and would respectfully ask for your support in moving this bill to Ways and Means and having it get its due consideration there. And I've, in the second page of my testimony, look at some of the various variables here within pilotage costs. Again, as I mentioned, this is not just about compensation, and certainly we want to maintain the standards and make sure that there is safe transit for marine vessels. But it includes pilot compensation, the transportation, the way they get from land out to the boat or out to the vessel, pilot training, the total number of vessel transits, the total number of pilots, pilot productivity, the dispatch system, how efficient that is, and then the rate case overhead itself. Jeff will tell you a little bit about his own experience in watching and now participating actually in rate cases before the Board of Maritime Pilots, but these are usually affairs, oftentimes affairs, that last for months at a time, well below the radar screen, and cost hundreds of thousands, if not a total of millions, in attorney fees. So thank you very much for your consideration. I will be happy to take your questions, but I'd like to first turn it over to Jeff Krug from the Port of Portland. Thank you.
Jeff, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Krug, and I'm General Manager of Marine Operations for the Port of Portland. I've been at the Port of Portland for 5 years, and just as background, before that, I was with worked with a Japanese ocean carrier shipping line for 10 years before that. So actually, I was very familiar with bringing ships in and out of the Port of Coos Bay during that time, and I know very well what the Port of Coos Bay has experienced, and I'll speak a little bit about that in my testimony, but I would like to just amplify on a little bit of the points that Pat brought up about why the Port of Portland is interested in this particular issue. And the first thing that really jumps out at us is as we travel and meet with our potential ocean carrier customers, the people that operate the ships, and our existing customers, we're hearing a lot about the fact that the rates to bring ships in and out of the Columbia River into the Port of Portland are too high. And we have had customers actually ask us to subsidize those rates to try to get to bring their ships into the port. Well, we're not in the business of subsidizing services to bring ships into the port, but I guess the point is that these higher rates are definitely playing a factor as we try to capture business for the Port of Portland and the state of Oregon. One of the things that also is a trend that is not good for the overall state is the decline in vessel volumes over the recent years. In the mid-90s, when I was involved with the Japanese shipping company, we were, you know, the overall vessel volume into the Port of Coos Bay was 200 ships a year plus. Last year, they had around 50 ships, from what I understand, come into the Port of Coos Bay. At the same time, the Columbia River vessel volumes have dropped significantly. In the late 90s, we had 2,000 ships a year come into the Columbia River system. We're down to around 1,600 ships a year now. So that's a drop of 400 ships, and certainly each ship that does not call the Columbia River or Coos Bay, there's a loss of jobs, trade-related jobs associated with that. So we think this is a very alarming trend, and it is a signal, I think, that we need to look at change, and this bill talks about evaluating one component of the transportation system and our competitiveness in the region. Pat also talked about our competitiveness with the ports in the Puget Sound, and certainly in the container and auto business, the fact that we have the rate spreads that we have definitely is a competitive disadvantage for the ports. And that disadvantage and those rate trends are only increasing over time. A couple other examples just of ship rates to bring a car carrier, for example, into the Port of Portland would cost about $22,000 right now. The same ship going into the Port of Tacoma costs about $8,000. So like the container example you heard about, big differences in the overall pilotage costs coming to the river. Pilotage costs are a key component when ocean carriers are considering where they're going to take their ships. And make no mistake about it, it's not the only factor, but it is one of the key factors when people look at deploying ships into a particular region. And we think certainly these higher rates are impacting Oregon's ability to attract international trade to this state. And I just got back last week from a trip to Asia. I was in Taiwan, Shanghai, and Seoul, Korea, and the trade outlook for this state is very bright. The China manufacturing base, our ability to export Oregon products to China, the future is very bright, and we are geographically situated in a very advantageous area to participate in this trade. But we've got to have a competitive package to attract that business. So I guess I'd like to say in summary that the trend in pilotage rates are increasingly becoming an issue for our customers. The Port of Portland, the Port of Vancouver, and the Port of Longview have recently joined together and are now actively participating in the rate-making process with the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots because the combined three ports realize this is a competitive issue for us. And this rate-making process that we have in place is also a contributory to the fact that we have some higher costs. I've watched the rate-making process for the pilotage services in the state for 15 years. There's a lot of extra costs and burden that ultimately are passed on to the system because of that. And finally, I'd like to say that there is a need to review the pilotage services in the state and also look at the system, how the services are implemented. We can look at training pilots to work in Coos Bay, the Columbia River Bar, as just one possible way to drive some efficiencies and lower costs into the system. So I would certainly ask that this committee strongly consider Senate Bill 961.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. I understand exactly that you're talking about the cost of doing business, and there's always that consideration. This bill is about a task force, and I want to know how you connect those dots. What is this task force going to do that's going to help us lower the cost of doing business in Oregon?
Madam Chair, thank you very much for the question. My own view on this is the conversation that I think needs to be had about pilotage has not been had, and in the current framework, very likely may not be had because the rate making process. In my little involvement, and Jeff's, I think, giving you a little bit of a perspective on it, is it's relatively confrontational. It's a very small group of folks that get involved in this, and they are not able to, nor do they hear from outside sources to object. Look at these costs. It's very much a us versus them kind of an environment. I think 961 and a task force, and again, I'll be the first to say I'm not sure that this is the perfect panacea for this issue. There may be other ways to force this conversation, to force the kids at the table, frankly, to talk beyond the rate case environment. But I think if you had, let's say, the funds to do it, and I'd be happy to talk about that a little bit, if you had the funds to do it and you had the professional staff associated with it and the representation of not just pilots, but the shippers themselves and a variety of other folks looking at this issue, I think you'd be able to get to some of these costs, such as transportation, such as maybe a dispatch system, and cut some of the costs out of the system. Portland is probably going to be more expensive in any case just because of the things that I mentioned, the additional transit and the dangerous bar. But can we do a better job about being more efficient? I think we can. I just don't believe that conversation is being had in the confines of a rate hearing.
Okay. So let me be really clear with you. what you'd like to accomplish here is to start the conversation, for one thing,
mm-hmm.
and this is not an us and them. This is
That's
everybody that is involved coming to the table with the common good in their mind, the goal of the common good, and in a way of trying to figure out what you can do to help bring down some of these high rates that are causing us to lose ships. When I moved to Coos Bay, I can always remember that it was equal to a ship a year. So we had 365, so that you can compare that mm-hmm. with your numbers
mm-hmm.
you just gave.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to be really clear that this, it also says appropriates money from the general fund, which says, ouch. So what would you say to that?
Madam Chair, a couple of things. Back to your first question again. I've been around a lot of task forces. I've seen some of them be very productive. I've seen others be a complete waste of time, and I'll be the first to say that. Is this the perfect way to have this conversation? I don't know. It could be an interim legislative committee. It could be we've talked about the board itself, although I've got my own concerns on that, just because very vested interest, and there's certain makeup of the board that I think kind of leads you back to that same conversation over and over again. The cost itself potentially could be borne as part of the tariff itself. There have been agreements among the parties in the past to look at and do economic studies and have that be figured in and paid for by all of the parties essentially as part of the rate case itself. I will say that this 961 and the payment of that has not been raised at the board level or among the parties, so that would be a conversation that if you move this bill on to Ways and Means, we potentially could have that conversation. General fund's very difficult this session. I'll be the first to recognize that.
So I'm to understand that if this bill were to move forward, you would be willing to follow it along, offer to have other alternatives
Absolutely.
Than the general fund?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. This actually, when you just look at you are putting together a task force, but what needs to be accomplished is huge. In Oregon, we have got to be more competitive, and that's not just with maritime. That is across the board. We have got to become more competitive with our economy if we're going to expect it to grow. So I thank you very much. I'm going to open it now to any questions that anybody else may have, and no one else is here. I know that's very distracting to you to see people. It's like a puppet show, and somebody's down, dropping these people down. But
you have a lot of moving parts and pieces.
Yeah. All right. But I apologize. You have had my undivided attention. So
thank
if
you,
that's and Senator Whitsitt's, I'm sure.
Thanks.
So I will call on Tom Gallagher and Dave Fiscom. Afternoon, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Columbia River Bar Pilots, and I won't go over everything that's in my testimony. I was listening to the conversation that you were having, and in great many ways agree with the representatives of the Port of Portland who were just up here. There needs to be a different kind of a dialogue going on the Columbia River. And my major objection to this bill, like a couple of the other bills that have been introduced on the pilots, are they only focus on the pilots. This is not a bill about reducing the costs or fixing the costs of the river system. It's a bill about the pilotage costs. The pilotage costs are higher in the Port of Portland because of the transportation system on the bar is expensive. There are many other bars in the world that have, or ports in the world that have a bar like that one with a transportation system, and it's a long river. The four ways that I can think of to cut pilotage costs on the river are to cut the cost of the transportation system, cut the wages of the pilots, minor savings can be done in reducing the overhead, or you could find ways to reduce the number of pilots. At least the last two require the groups to work together to maintain the safety of the river, to maintain the efficiency of the system, and would require a level of cooperation that we've been unable to achieve among the competing groups on the river. I do not know why that is impossible to do, but I can see no way in which this bill would get us to that point. There's only one pilot. Of all the pilot groups, there's only one pilot on this 10-person committee. It only focuses on pilot costs. We can agree on the problem with the pilot costs right now. We've all talked about it. We're in a rate case right now. We have been through three rate cases over pilotage costs in which a public board, the Board of Maritime Pilots, appointed by the governor, has made decisions hearing all the arguments on the costs and the charges and the rate. And we're going through another case right now. As a matter of fact, pilotage costs are the only regulated charge on the river. The rest of them are publicly done. The rest of them aren't. So we already have a public process. In terms of why these conversations haven't occurred, I participated in a group put together at the Port of Portland, which we heartily agreed in over the last year and a half, to get the groups together at the port to talk. There's been a major study commissioned out of the rate case just done by Quantec, looking at the costs and the overhead charges on the river. There's meetings of the pilot groups that go on almost bimonthly right now talking about these issues. And there are subcommittees of the Board of Maritime Pilots talking about these issues. I agree with Pat. We need to find a marriage counselor that's going to work these parties through this inability to approach this in a good management way. But putting together a task force has never in my history of all of the task force I participated on in Oregon provided exactly that kind of a safe, nurturing environment where the parties can sit down and work out complicated issues. With that, I'll stop and turn it over to my colleague Dave and take any questions whenever you want.
All right, Dave.
Madam Chair, for the record, Dave Fiscom here this afternoon representing the Columbia River Pilots. Before I make a few comments to you, I did want to compliment two of your senators on their choice of ties today. They're showing very good taste, I might add. My guys are the ones who take ships up and down river between Astoria and Portland. I'm appearing here today to raise some questions about Senate Bill 961. I do so in the name of the president of our group, Captain Steve Brown, who intended to be here today, save for a doctor's appointment. The Capitol, in government, in my numbers of years of experience, there are usually two reasons why task forces such as that embodied in 961 are proposed. The one is a tactic to delay something. The other is a genuine attempt to look at an issue and come up with recommendations for the next legislature. And I'm going to assume the latter is the case. Whether it results in that or whether the outcome occurs will depend on intervening events. But what I do want to do is raise some questions with you today as you consider 961. First, representation. In any task force on any subject, you should review very carefully in the law who you assign to be on a task force. Mr. Gallagher has made a good point. In Oregon today, there are essentially two main pilot groups. One is the bar pilots. Those are Tom's clients who take ships over one of this country's and this world's toughest bars. Requires special skills. Those are a different breed of professional than are my clients, the 45 pilots who take ships up and down river. Some years ago, and appearing before the legislature, the reality of our situation was that the average time a pilot spent on a barge on the river learning the river was 16 years. There's no magic to that. It didn't have to be 16. That was the arithmetic result, the average. What that simply shows is that the skill required, and it's been described to me in this way, not being a pilot, is that the persons I represent need to have the ability to take a ship up and up or down river nearly blindfolded, because in fact sometimes they are with fog. Point simply is there are two kinds of pilots in Oregon, and to the extent this is a review of pilotage, you need to have, in my judgment, my suggestion to you, both groups represented. Second issue is leadership. My experience with task forces like this is that they're more effective when there is leadership provided by legislative and executive branches to an enterprise like this, where somebody or buddies can take leadership to drive disparate interests, stakeholders competing competing interests toward a consensus, and that requires leadership in my judgment. And I don't see where that exists in this group, but maybe leadership is something which emerges and you see it when it does. Funding, you've already raised this. My experience also shows that enterprises such as this require funding to enable the volunteers who serve to have the benefit of access to staff, as well as resources to the extent that such a group decided there was a study or an analysis that needed to be done. So funding is an issue. Mr. Egan has mentioned that, and that can be an issue that's resolved at some point in Ways and Means. Fourthly, the assignment to the group, another critical dimension, revolves around the charter, the commission, the assignment you give such a group that's covered in Section 3 of the bill, perhaps not covered adequately yet. The cost of pilotage, as Mr. Gallagher said, is one aspect of a far larger set of costs dealing with economic commerce on the river, which ought to be a source of concern to all of us, and is. Oregon, Portland, suffers from one disadvantage. Two pilots are required to take ships to Portland or other ports along the way, one to bring a ship over the bar and one to bring a ship upriver. That situation only exists, as best I can tell, from my client in one other place, New Orleans, where in some cases there are three pilots, one to bring a ship over the bar there, and sometimes, depending on the transit on that river, two more pilots based on the skills necessary to get a ship to the proper location. That's a disadvantage we have that nobody will ever be able to change. It's just reality. In summary, Madam Chair, committee members, we're prepared to work with you, with Ways and Means members, with House members of the relevant committees, if it's decided that the best approach is to create this task force and to see if we can make recommendations to the 2007 legislative session. With that, I'll stop, and Mr. Gallagher and I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you very much. I looked at some of your testimony, especially Mr. Gallagher's, who gave us some choices here, and I didn't think I liked any of them. Reducing the pilot certainly doesn't help. We've done that in Coos Bay. I think there may be one half of one there, so I don't think that's the answer. Reducing their wages is not the answer. They have one of the most dangerous jobs. That certainly is not an answer. I guess that what I'd like to ask you is, besides having a little different representation and the fact that sometimes many task force don't work, what would you suggest that you think is a better suggestion than Senate Bill 961?
Madam Chair, I was, first of all, very serious when I said on behalf of my client that to the extent that you and your colleagues in this legislature, Port of Portland, thought this was a good idea, we're prepared to cooperate with it. I think what I would say is that the issue of the cost of commerce on the river is far larger than, if I can say it this way, just pilotage. As important as pilotage is, as important a factor as that is, and we're prepared to look at that issue, it's one issue among many that relate to the ability to be competitive in the way that Mr. Egan has described for the Port of Portland. And so to the extent that you wanted to really look at the issue, it's the cost of commerce on the river more broadly with all factors considered. To the extent you do, you convene a pilotage task force, we're prepared to work with you and to serve on it, if in the spirit of my comments, to produce an outcome that can. Questions about pilotage have persisted for so many years that sometimes I get tired of dealing with them in my role as their representative here at the Capitol. And to the extent that a task force like this can help to bring some at least greater understanding or closure to the issue, that's the spirit of my comment that suggests that we will, in fact, work with the task force. Maybe this is the only way to resolve questions that seem to persist and have answers that not enough people will accept.
Tom?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry, I'll let my colleague go first in answering that question. I have been pondering this question of how you bring irreconcilable forces and objects together in public policy. Let me just throw something out. Suppose when you do the Board of Maritime Pilots budget or the ODOT budget down in Ways and Means, you direct through a budget note that the Department of Transportation, or working through the Port of Portland, convenes the groups and reports back to the Interim Transportation Committee four times over the course of the next biennium as to the progress they've made on solving the issues as identified by Mr. Egan and Mr. Krug. Now, budget notes are not binding on people, so they can always shuffle it off. But I think that the fact that the legislature is taking a hand in this and giving the parties another chance, and I would look to the direction of the Port of Portland here much more than the Department of Transportation, it may be an effective way to deal with this. And it is actually in that case, it doesn't have a fiscal with it that's going to hold you up and stealing money from the basic school support that you would have to do. It's a horrible thing. So that's one suggestion.
Thank you for that. One person that's going to be coming up is from the department, and I'll pose that question to them. One thing you can't do in that is you cannot legislate people to play well with others.
So. That's true, Madam Chair, but you can make their misbehavior very painful.
All right, thank you.
Step back now,
and I'll call Lori Sundstrom from the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Good afternoon, Chair Verger. Members of the committee, my name is Lori Sundstrom, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Transportation. You've heard a lot of information from the previous presenters about the technical issues associated with this matter, so I'm not going to repeat any of that for you. I thought, though, it would be useful to you to have some background on the relationship between the Board of Maritime Pilots and the department. The board is a freestanding board, although it is a part of the Oregon Department of Transportation and identified as an area of critical concern. They are part of our budget presentation, and they will be with us in Ways and Means later in May. The Oregon Transportation Commission does not have anything to do with the day-to-day operations of the board or any of the decision-making, so I wanted to be clear that those are separate and distinct bodies. The board's, as I said earlier, the board's budget is part of ODOT's budget. ODOT does have a seat on the board in an ex officio capacity, and I do serve as the agency's representative on the board. Senate Bill 961 directs ODOT to provide staff support to a task force to do the things that you have just heard about. And what I'm here today to tell you is that the department is ready and able to perform that task. I do want to point out, however, that we cannot use highway funds for that purpose, and you have already discussed some of the funding implications. And that concludes my remarks.
All right. Thank you very much, Laura. You've all heard the testimony and a couple of suggestions that have been made. I would like to know from the committee members, if possible, your analysis of the task force idea and of the makeup of the task force. I'm very willing to move the bill if we feel that that is the best way to go. There are a number of options, obviously, for you. So if I can hear from maybe the two of you, what you think. Senator Brzezinski, do you think task force? I would like to see the issue addressed in some way. I think that we have a very serious issue. And if by passing the 961, Dave Biscom has said that they would be willing to work with them, I do feel that perhaps more pilots should be on. If there are two groups, then certainly both groups should be represented.
That would be my concern, that the group most likely to be regulated here is at least representation on the makeup of the group. I think that the concern that there might be a group of legislative leadership here might also be a concern. Perhaps at least it looks like it could. Is it possible in this situation to have the legislature appointing these members?
Madam Chair, I guess, of course, unfortunately, I didn't get to hear all the testimony, but what I did hear was some of the concerns that Senator Wissett mentioned, and I did hear Mr. Fiskum talk about the concerns. I'm wondering, I mean, I'm not sure what the cost would be to actually have a task force, how often they're going to be meeting. I'm wondering if this is something that if the chair would like to consider this as an interim project, something that would be done through our services, and that we would basically take up the issue and have different people come in and meet. I mean, I'm not sure how much meeting time it's going to take to ID or scope the issue and issues, and being able to actually maintain some type of continuity. But when you do look at the number of people, if there's not some type of directive as to who's going to be more or less helping to facilitate the process, I think that we may just could potentially have impasse without any work being able to be accomplished. Not knowing the different makeup of those who are suggested, clearly we don't have anyone from the legislative branch, and the governor only gets to appoint one member from each of these areas, and just not knowing what the result of that those appointments would be.
I think that the issue is of utmost importance. Whether this is the venue to solve it, I don't know. I think in the essence of time today, I'm going to close the public hearing, and I would like to meet with those of you and talk about how we might proceed, even during the interim, either legislatively. But I really don't want this to die. I want this to continue on until we get something moving. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 961. And I'm going to skip down. I don't see Senator Deckard here right now. So I'm going to skip down to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 640. We're going to lose our vice chair and I want him here for that hearing. So I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 640.
Okay, are you ready? Thank you, Madam Chair, members. You should have eight amendments, actually, that we are going to review at the present moment. I will be reviewing the dash 3s, 4s, 5s, 6, 12, 13, 14, and 15. And members of the audience, there are extra copies of all those at the back of the room. I'm going to describe the dash 3s and then describe how each of the other amendments differ from the dash 3s. Okay. The dash 3 amendments require an applicant to provide two forms of biometric data that establish the identity of the person to the satisfaction of the department. It would apply to driver's licenses, driver permits, and identification cards issued on or after January 1st, 2007. The measure, the dash 3 amendments direct the Department of Transportation to require a person to provide two forms of biometric data for the purpose of establishing the person's identity prior to issuing, renewing, replacing, or reinstating those documents. It provides that the biometric data is required in addition to the proofs of identity, age, and residence already required by rule.
Excuse me, Judith. Mm-hmm. Are the dash 3s included in the dash 4s?
Yes. The way that they were drafted, they each contain the dash 3s and then modify.
Everything's based on the dash 3s.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So in addition, the dash 3s direct the Department of Transportation it specifies that they will be satisfied with the establishment of the person's identity in the following circumstances. First, if the biometric data has been previously submitted, that the data matches with the current applicant that's before them. Or if biometric data has not previously been submitted, that the data does not match any other biometric data for all other persons for which the department has records, and that the department has no other reason to believe that the person is not who they claim to be. The dash threes direct the Department of Transportation, if identity theft is suspected, to notify appropriate law enforcement, DMV field offices, and the person who might be the victim of that identity theft. It exempts department and the department and employees from liability for any damages resulting from issuing any the identification document under another person's identity if they had reason to believe when they issued it that it was appropriate. It requires the department to retain the biometric data. It prohibits the data from being made available to anyone other than law enforcement acting under an authorized subpoena or search warrant, or the department employees acting in their official capacity. It authorizes the department to impose a fee not to exceed $2 for issuing these licenses for the purposes of covering the cost of buying the equipment and establishing the database. It would repeal the fee on January 1st, 2000. I have a long date on here. Let me double check this. It would repeal the fee on January 1st, 2011. On my SMS, it says 2001, but that would be 2011. It repeals ORS 807.162, which is the part of the statutes that deal with the proof of identity for replacement licenses, permits, and identification cards, and finally prescribes January 1st, 2007 as the effective date.
And sure.
Yes.
If our committee administrator is completed with dash three, I have a question. I did not hear in that rendition anything about how the DLs or the ID or the permit card will be actually produced and delivered. Is it going to be on-site, real-time, or is it going to go centralized?
Okay, the dash threes leave it the system as it is with
okay.
The field offices.
Okay.
The dash fours then are the measure that would add the centralized issuance by mail. If you look on the dash fours, page 2, line 7, is where it's talking about the centralized issuance by mail. So that's how the dash fours differ from the dash threes. And I believe it would be most clear then at this point to say the dash 13s are the dash fours, that is, includes the centralized issuance by mail, but also includes contract language, which would allow the extension of a contract. Let me get the exact language here for you. The contract language that I will be now referring to on several of the amendments would say that the department may, without competitive sealed bidding, competitive sealed proposals, or other competition required under ORS Chapter 279, would allow the department to extend any contract related to the security procedures, processes, and materials used in the preparation, manufacture, and issuance of driver's licenses, permits, or ID cards, provided that the extended contract is financially prudent and consistent with the provisions of the measure. So that would be the contract language. In the dash 13 could be the dash 4s, that is the centralized mail, with the contract language. The dash 5s are identical to the dash 3s, except if you look in section 11 on page 9 of the dash 5s, you'll see a 4-year renewal cycle. That's where they're talking about renewing licenses, the cards, every 4 years instead of currently it's 8 years, and it halves all the fees so that indeed citizens are still over an 8-year period still paying the same amount of fees.
So that the dash fives equals the dash threes plus the 4-year renewal.
Correct.
Okay.
And the dash 14s are the dash fives with, again, that contract language. Okay, and finally, the dash 6s Again, are the dash threes with this change on page of the dash six is page 9, section 10. It would provide a blank that is for funding to purchase the appropriate technology to accomplish collecting the biometric data. It would authorize the department to apply for federal funding as well as gifts, grants, and donations, again, for the purchase of that equipment, and would, in fact, have the effective date July 1st, 2005 to begin that process. The dash 15s, then, are the dash 6s, again, with the technology components, with, again, the ability to extend the contract and the contract language I provided previously. And if that isn't confusing enough, you do have in your materials a memo from Legislative Council trying to track those changes for you.
That's what I was going to suggest, Judith. We really need a summary so that we can have it where we are shown with each one. I'm going to just stop temporarily. We have a full committee, and I am going to temporarily close. I don't want to close the hearing. I want to recess the hearing on Senate Bill 640, and I want to open the work session on Senate Bill 71. Senate Bill 71 is a bill that the committee have been working on for quite some time. It is what we call Connect Oregon. This is a monumental day for us. This comes at the close of many work sessions and lots of conversation about Connect Oregon. Judith, tell us a little bit about 71 and what it does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remember, Senate Bill 71 is the measure that authorizes the issuance of lottery bonds for transportation projects. It specifies the use of those monies, sunsets provisions January 2nd, 2008, and would declare an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. You have before you the dash 4 amendments. The dash 4 amendments replace the original bill and do the following. The dash 4s create the multimodal transportation fund, specifies use of the monies for grants and loans for transportation projects involving air, marine, public transit, and rail projects. It defines transportation projects as provided under ORS 367.010. The dash 4s provide that bond proceeds and interest on the loans received would be deposited in the multimodal transportation fund. It authorizes the state treasurer to issue lottery bonds to finance those grants and loans. It states findings upon which the use of the lottery bonds is based. It limits the aggregate principal amount of lottery bonds to $100 million or less, plus an additional amount established by the state treasurer to pay bond-related costs. It allows the Department of Transportation to provide grants and loans for transportation projects to both public bodies and private entities with an annual Oregon revenue stream of less than $40 million. It prohibits grants and loans for projects that could constitutionally be funded under basically the highway fund. Requires ODOT to adopt rules specifying the application processes and prescribing terms and conditions of the loans. It requires a public body or private entity receiving grants, this is grants only, to provide at least 20% of the monies required by the project in question. It authorizes the Transportation Commission to select the transportation projects. It requires the Oregon Transportation Commission to consider recommendations from the State Aviation Board for airport projects, the Freight Advisory Committee for freight transportation projects, and the Public Transit and Rail Advisory Committees for public transit and rail projects. It requires the Commission to consider additional factors. If you look in the Dash 4 amendments on page 4, beginning on line 6, there is a whole sequence of what they are to consider as additional factors in selecting those projects. Again, page 4, starting on line 6. It allows those mentioned advisory committees to recommend specific projects, again, based on those same criteria. It requires the commission to allocate at least 15% of net lottery bond proceeds for projects in each congressional district in the state, and not more than 30% going to any one projects cumulatively in any one congressional district. It specifies that 40% of the net lottery bond proceeds would be used for loans and 60% for grants. It directs the commission to transfer monies for aeronautic and airport transportation projects, including administrative costs, from the Multimodal Transportation Fund to the Department of Aviation for purposes of administering those particular projects. It authorizes the Department of Transportation to administer all the other projects and allows the department to pay related administrative costs, again, from the Multimodal Transportation Fund, and would prescribe July 1st, 2005 as the effective date.
Thank you very much, Judith. We are in work session. Senator Whitsett?
Madam Chair, I move the dashboard amendment to committee.
The Senator Whitsett moves the dashboard amendments to Senate Bill 71. All right.
Discussion.
Yes,
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate all the hard work that so many people have participated on in this, and we'll certainly be supporting this. But I just wanted to go on the record on a few issues. I think with the Dash Force really put together a lot of the concerns that people had. I know some of the things that I had submitted to you in the Dash 3s are included here, and Senator Starr is working aggressively, you and others, and I just think this was a real good team effort. There's a few things, though, I just want to voice a few concerns on. On page 4 of the amendment, line 6 and 7, I know in the Dash 3 I had deleted one of the considerations, which is whether a proposed transportation project results in an economic benefit to the state. That is so broad you could drive one of Bob Russell's trucks through it. I mean, anything results in economic benefit, and I just didn't think that really helped us when we were trying to narrow things down, but it's not an insurmountable issue. On page 5, I did have concerned about the about the difference between the grants and the loans, and this is very close to what I had. I was thinking of 65-35, and I appreciate the work that was done on that. And then the only other issue, that I had, I do have concerns about the requirement that each congressional district gets something, because part of this idea is not to distribute capital but to improve the freight and transportation of the state. And, I don't see this as an impediment for doing that, but I think the really focus should be on whether a transportation project, I would like it much better if it said that the distribution of these funds demonstrated an improvement that could be recognized by each congressional district, as opposed to it had to necessarily be in that congressional district. I know in my own district, I can go 12 miles, and I have 3 congressional districts where I am, in Clackamas. So certainly my Senate district could have the majority of that money, but never really leave Clackamas. So, but I appreciate what we need to do there, and I just wanted to put those observations on the record. At the same time saying, I think this is, as you said, Madam Chair, a monumental effort. I'm sure I'll probably get a few more tweaks in Ways and Means, but my congratulations to the chair and everyone who is. This is an important piece of legislation, and thank you for all your efforts.
Thank you very much. Any other comments, Senator Whitford?
I would share, Madam Chair, in applauding your effort. There are a few things in the Dash 4s that I am. I think I perhaps weakened the bill, and one of those is I really believe that this bill was a freight bill, and we have reestablished transit, public transit, quite prominently in the bill. It would appear that on page 3, line 5, the less than $40 million appears to eliminate Class A railroad carriers from consideration. Page 4, line 1, of course, the Oregon Economic Development Department has been written out of the advisory capacity. I don't have an opinion on that. I just wanted to point out that that's
right.
The
sure.
case.
Sure.
And then on page 4, lines 25-27, and the subsequent list, I would have liked to have seen that changed a little bit and prioritized. It's already been mentioned that the 40-60 loan to grant ratio has been reversed. And other than that, my primary concern, though, is that the we have again inserted a great deal of public transit language in this great bill.
Okay. Thank you very much for those remarks. Senator Krasanski, any comments?
Madam Chair, I think it's work that's, let's say, has gone through the process, and not everyone's happy with what's there, but it definitely shows that we're moving forward, I still believe, and sometimes you have to take what you may not favor with what you do favor, and this is one that's actually going to allow us to move into the next step. And I think the bottom line is it does provide for all four components of our transportation system. And I guess what I would say on that is that this is the framework of what we're going to have, not only for the next 2 years, but for in the future. And I would expect as different needs of the state, as it comes to transportation, freight, present themselves, we'll see an emphasis put on one of those four as needed. And hopefully we'll have that activity that I think the group that's worked with this, and I also commend the chair for your desire to make sure we got something out this session. And I think this is something that is a good starting point, and we will in fact result benefit to our freight system by accommodating all of these various needs at the appropriate time.
Thank you very much, Senator Sansky. Senator Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to compliment you on your leadership in pulling together the interested parties as it relates to getting this bill and the amendments put together. In my experience in this building, what generally is passed is not passed in the form that it would if I were the only drafter. But I understand that as part of this process, and I certainly believe the Dash 4 amendments improve this bill from its original state, and it's a step in the right direction, and support it, and hopefully we'll move it to the next stage.
Thank you for those comments.
Madam Chair, one other thing. I guess what we're all trying to say is that this is really good sausage through the process.
Well, I'd like to think it's a good state, but that's all a matter. All right. Those of the opinion that the Dash 4 amendments should be adopted shall say aye, and those opposed no, and the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Brzozowski?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Whitson?
Aye.
Chair Berger?
Aye. All right. We need a motion to move.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill Senate Bill 71 as amended to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
And to be referred,
and to, be referred to Ways and Means.
Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, just for reference, it will go to the floor and then the Ways and Means?
It'll go to Ways and Means.
All right, so motions to Ways and Means. I just want to...
That, right, it goes to Ways and Means.
Okay.
All right, so those of the opinion that Senate Bill 71 as amended should be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation with two Ways and Means by prior reference will vote aye, and those opposed no, and the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Brzozowski?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Whitfield?
Aye.
Chair Berger?
Aye. Thank you, committee. It was indeed a team effort. I'm proud of the work that we did, and I hope that Governor Kulongoski is proud of the work that we've done. This was his bill, brought by his staff, and I look forward to hearing what he has to say about it, and I wish it all the luck in the world in going through Ways and Means, and it might need it. So, all right, with that, I'm going to return, Judith, and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 640. And I want to say that I have some people who want to testify on the bill, but with this many amendments, I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm going to need some help in knowing exactly what these amendments do and how they change things. Senator Brzezinski?
Yeah, Madam Chair, also I understand that we're just basically taking in, I guess, really all of these amendments, and we're going to have an opportunity to actually, let's say, digest it.
Absolutely.
Before we move forward. I do want to put on the record that two of the individuals, I know we have some people here to testify, but
Sheriff Ramirez and myself and another gentleman, which is Lieutenant Jeffrey Carr, I believe. We met last week, actually before our transportation meeting in Dundee. I actually was late because we were meeting down at one of the local establishments there in Dundee. And I have received, I know they're out of state this week for a separate business. And they'll be back, and I told them I would get back with them regarding maybe some possible changes. I've worked on that, and I will be doing that. I want to make sure the chair knows.
Okay.
And I've also told some of the other people within the work group. And so this is definitely a work in progress. It seems like we're moving in the right direction of trying to address all the concerns that that have been raised and making sure that we take the appropriate steps. But I assume that the chair will be looking at having this come back in the near future once we have an opportunity.
I have already put in a request that this be one of the bills. There'll be several bills that we need to hear. And so I will be meeting with the President of the Senate on Monday, going over those bills and asking a request, and 640 will be one of them. So this is simply, I brought it back for our work, public hearing today to give other people an opportunity to testify if they wanted to, but also to give us an opportunity to talk about the amendments if we need to, but I think that I did not anticipate this many amendments, so I think that I'm glad that I brought it back just for a little bit of this discussion. And I'm going to call Senator Winters, I don't believe is going to come this afternoon. She just came back for her first day today after open heart surgery. Looks wonderful, recuperating nicely. So I'm going to call Cindy, is it Birmingham? Welcome, Cindy. If you'll give your name and the city in which you reside for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Cindy Birmingham, and I live in Portland, in the Washington County, part of Portland. And I was asked to come here today by the Washington County Fight Team, which is the team against identity theft, and also by Multnomah County Police Department because of an experience that my husband and I faced a couple of years ago regarding identity theft, just so that the committee could hear a little bit about the impact that it has on the individual when they go through the identity theft. Ours happened about 2 years ago. My husband's wallet was stolen. And well, I'll start by saying we were somewhat fortunate in that, you know, when in terms of this bill, in that the person that stole his identity used our address and my husband's license to do the identity theft, which meant the bills came to our house, so we actually found out fairly quickly. Many people don't find out for months down the road. But I think the thing that I want to focus on, and I'll keep this short because I know there's a lot of other things to discuss, but there's two different types of tolls that identity theft takes on a person. One is the physical toll, and that includes things like just the, simply the amount of time. I have a job. I work, you know, 40-plus hours a week. At the time, my husband was a student trying to get his bachelor's degree. The amount of time that it takes once the identity theft starts and starts proliferating, I never would have believed it if I hadn't been through it myself. It's probably 2 to 4 hours a day spent for weeks, spent on the phone with credit card companies, you know, detectives, police officers, you know, the various places, first trying to convince them, yes, it really was identity theft. Second, going through all the affidavits for each place where this person opened an account in my husband's name. We had to fill out affidavits, get, you know, there's a cost associated with that because you have to get those notarized. We spent a ton of hours and money, and there was just a physical toll of trying to deal with all of this and waiting every day until the mail came to find out what credit card's going to come in the mail today. Even though within a week we'd put a fraud alert on his account, we had no idea how many accounts were out there. So just the physical toll, the time and the money that it took for us to deal with this problem. There's another toll that it takes, and that's the emotional toll, and that's the fear. Part of the fear was dreading that call that I was going to get at 3 o'clock every day when the mail came of which credit card, which company is it that we have to call today to find out, you know, how much was charged against us. And the fear that there's this person out there, he knows my husband's name, he knows my husband's social security number, he knows our address, he knows where we live, he knows a lot of very personal information about us that he was able to get through using our identification. And I spoke many times with the detectives, and that, you know, they kept reassuring me that, no, he's probably not going to come to my house. But just knowing that information is out there and that it was so easy for him to do this, and it's really a fear that lasts for the rest of your life, because you can't easily change, if at all, change your social security number and change all this information. So you spend basically wondering, is somebody holding on to this somewhere in a back alley, and 2 years from now they're going to come back and start all over again when they think we're not paying attention or when they think the fraud alert's gone off. So just with all of those different things, identity theft is a nightmare for the person that it happens to. And if it hasn't happened to you or to anyone here, it seems like, you know, maybe just like a little fly that you have to get with a fly swatter. It's more like an airplane banging into your house, and it takes over your life. It took over our life for probably 6 months to a year, just trying to get everything. Well, just trying to get everything cleaned up. As a matter of fact, I would say probably longer than that. This was in June, July of 2003. About a month and a half ago, we went to Best Buy to buy a computer, and my husband filled out the form to get credit. Well, time had gone by, and we forgot that Best Buy is one of the places where our friendly identity theft had gone and opened an account in my husband's name. So they had my husband, you know, my husband's targeted as anything that comes up in his name is a fraud thing, and, you know, there was going to take a lot of extra steps. So we had to basically start the whole account process over again and do it in my name because it was just too much hassle. So here we are a year and a half later, and this is still coming back to haunt us. You know, you have to keep an eye on your credit report basically for the rest of your life, because you just never know when they might take that information and go out and start making a mess again.
So the person wasn't caught.
The person was caught, but that doesn't mean the information might not still be out there. You know, a social security number, once it's out there, it's out there. You know, your driver's license information, you know, if you don't change the number or whatever, it's, you know, once it's out there, it's out there. You know, your address, unless you, you know, sell your house and move. Once it's out there, it's out there. So the impact of identity theft is ongoing.
So intrusive.
Oh, absolutely, in
privacy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like I said, it's not just the physical impact, the time and the money involved in cleaning up the mess, but it's also the emotional impact, the fear that it leaves, that, you know, from here on out, we have to watch very carefully everything that comes in the mail. And, you know, if you fill something out somewhere and forget that you have, I don't know, something coming, it's very scary. You get something in the mail, and I call my husband. I'm like, please tell me that you've, you know, requested whatever this is. The impact is great, and I really hope that you'll take that into consideration. Anything that I can do as a citizen to help reduce identity theft, so that you or anyone else in this room or anyone else in the state or country does not have to go through what we went through, I'll do.
Good for you. And you drove all the way to today on that horrible, busy freeway, I-5, to come down and tell us this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate that. That's very, very good. And willing to help other people go through it or do whatever you can do. You're a good person.
Okay. Do you have any other questions? Or?
No. Do you have any questions? No. Thank you again for your extra effort to help others. Okay, Jim Swinyard. Jim Swinyard from Benton. Nope. All right. Well, that will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 40. I don't see Senator Deckard here, so I don't want to open that one. We'll go down to Senate Bill 566. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 566, which prohibits Oregon Transportation Commission and the Department of Transportation from designating highway or portions of highway as freight route if also designated as historic and scenic highway. Is there anyone here on the bill. Senator Pruszynski, you have amendments to the bill?
I do, Madam Chair. What we have is a dash two that basically would rewrite the bill. If the committee remembers, we had a dash one that was basically going to rewrite the bill and just put a prohibition as it pertains to what is East Highway 126 from the east city limits of Springfield up to the junction up at the pass. Dash two includes that, but it also has incorporated the desire of Senator Johnston and her constituents of also designating part of Highway 101 between U.S. 26 and Highway 126 to Florence as being also a prohibition, an area that would be prohibited from being designated as a freight route.
Right.
That's basically what dash two does, and it looks like Senator Morissette is walking in.
All right. He is on his way.
And we also have...
he's on his way, right there.
And we also have a couple of engineers who were here from the city of Springfield and I believe the city of Eugene that may be here for additional testimony.
All right. Very good. Welcome, Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, District 6, representing parts of Lane and Linn County. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 6. 566. We try to make this bill as simple as possible to solve a problem that exists basically on Highway 126 east of Springfield that goes up to the junction with the Santiam Highway. There have been several major accidents. We had two very large community meetings. One about 5 months ago, maybe even longer, concerning a death that occurred at one of the intersections, and the room was full of people. The state police were there to hear the testimony, and their testimony was in return that they did not have the staff to patrol on a regular basis. That stretch of the road was one of the problems. There were a lot of concerns about speeding because it is basically almost a residential setting in some parts of the highway. There are something like 2,000 driveways that go on out into Highway 126. The second meeting we had concerned the possible redesignation as a freight route, and again there were about 300 people there and concerned with improvements that would have to be made to the highway if it was indeed a freight route, which meant frontage roads perhaps to not allow people to have direct access. Their driveways would no longer go out on the highway. There were other concerns, particularly from the Eugene Water and Electric Board. The city of Eugene gets its water basically from the McKenzie River, and the fire marshal from our volunteer, well, he was not actually a fire chief from the McKenzie area, testified that he was always concerned with the trucks that already travel. Now, we're not talking about taking truck traffic off of 126. That's never going to happen because it is a commerce highway in the sense there are gas stations and grocery stores that need to be serviced. But he was concerned that additional freight of various kinds of materials that would spill into the river could cause some real damage. And so we, meaning the Lane County delegation, which included Senator Pruszynski, were trying to find some simple solutions that would deal with Highway 126 and not involve a lot of the other highways, and it's not been easy. The Dash 2 amendments are the result of what we have come up with. There is another bill, and Bob Russell, who is representing the trucking industry, has a bill that would accomplish many of the goals that we want to accomplish, but has some complications. And as mayors, and having to deal with state highways running through the middle of our towns, we know that we don't have a lot of control sometimes of what the state policies are regarding our highways. Highway 126 is our main street, and I know we've had a lot of concerns about, well, even putting, where do we put the traffic lights? Can we have bike trails along the highway, which we can't? Are they closing curb cuts and so on. So I will stop right now, and I would like to introduce Len Goodwin. Len Goodwin, who is the engineer from the city of Springfield. He plays a flute?
Viola.
A viola. He plays a viola. You know, when he's out, when he's not working, he plays a viola. A little sidelight. I've worked with Len for many years. He was there when I was mayor, and he's been our main engineer. And so he just has a couple of concerns about the restrictions of space on a highway from 12 feet to 11 feet or whatever. So, Len, if you could.
Madam Chair, if we're going to take that testimony, we probably need to open up the other bill. 566 now, Senator Morissette, will not include any of the stuff dealing with what's in 894, which is the one that.
I'm sorry. Well, let me. Okay. I guess I will then just stop. To conclude my testimony, I would just say the last line 13, 14, 15 in this bill does include a section of Route 101 from the intersection of 101 and U.S. Route 26 to the intersection of 101 and Oregon 126. I think Senator Posansky might be able to expand upon that. I think the other bill covers most of 101. I have not personally interest in Highway 101. This bill concerns Highway 126.
And just for the record, as I mentioned previously, I think before you got in the room, Senator Johnson was looking to have this as an area that would be also designated or not designated as the McKenzie Highway. And so we've taken the language that she had proposed and just put it into the bill that would just basically prohibit those two stretches of roadway from being designated as freight.
Their testimony, I guess, concerns the other bill.
Concerns the other bill. So
we can close this.
Why don't I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 566?
I'll have
you step back,
yeah,
Bill,
sure.
And then we'll have Bob Russell come forward with Senate Bill 894. Is that right? 894.
Yep.
Welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and thank you again for opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 894. And yet again, we have some new amendments, and we're continuing to work on this bill. We now have the Dash 5 amendments that I would call your attention to. And sometimes I find myself overthinking problems, and I think in this particular case, the Dash 5 amendments are an example of when I have tried to simplify the problem. We kept trying to define terms in the existing statute, and this time we took those terms out and just put in the definition. So sort of the key language is Section 2, and how that now reads, except as provided in subsection 3 of this section, the commission may not permanently reduce the width of or the vertical clearance above the roadway or any traffic lane of a highway included in the national highway system when altering, relocating, changing, or realigning a state highway. So it's very clear, very succinct language. A roadway is defined in statute, so that's a known quantity. Of course, we left in place the process by which we can have conversations and make exceptions to this prohibition, which is subparagraph 3. We also have the Dash 4s, which are, my understanding, is identical to the Dash 2s that you just looked at for Senate Bill 566. So that's sort of a choice. At this point, I'm continuing to talk with folks from the city of Springfield, from folks from Eugene and Metro and the Bicycle Alliance. when we look at this prohibition, and I hope that everybody would agree at this point that it's very clear what it is. It is the hole in the air that I have been trying to describe, that allows, it's large enough to drive a big truck through. There continue to be some problems, but there's a couple of ways to address those problems. And let me use some examples. And by no means would this be an entirely complete list, but in Springfield, you've got Franklin Avenue, you've got Main Street. Both are state highways, and both are on the national highway system. In Eugene, you've got 6th and 7th Streets. In the Portland metro area, you've got Highway 43. The concern is that local governments want to control the destiny of what have become, in essence, local streets. And I certainly sympathize with their concern. The two ways that they can deal with it is, one, they could do the process that's outlined in the statute, and they could go to the Transportation Commission and ask for an exception to subparagraph 2. The other way of dealing with it is to take it off the national highway system. In discussions that I've had with both the Department of Transportation and with the Federal Highway Administration, you know, the NHS was established many, many years ago, and things have changed fairly dramatically since that time. And there are roads in urban areas that are on the national highway system that really no longer perform that function, and quite frankly should be removed. And I think that some of this, the roads that I'm talking, that I just named, are in that category. What I would like to do is to see if we can't get some assurance to particularly Eugene, Springfield, and Metro on Highway 43, and that the routes that they are concerned about would be in that classification of national highway system highways that really don't belong as national highway system highways any longer, and see if we can't assure them that perhaps we can solve their problem by just taking them out of the NHS, and this statute then would not apply at all. At this point, those folks continue to be opposed to 894, and I understand that, but we are continuing to talk. We talked before the hearing and agreed to talk afterwards. So that's sort of an update of where we are. I do want to thank you for your patience. We've been working on this bill for quite some time. And I also want to thank the folks from Springfield, from Eugene, Metro, and Scott from the Bicycle Alliance. It's been a civil conversation as we've discussed all of this.
Well, let's call some of these folks up that want to testify on it. From the city of Eugene, there's Christopher Henry and Leonard Goodwin from the city of Springfield. And why don't we ask Scott to come up. Scott, come up at the same time. We'll hear from the two cities and then from you. All right. Who wants to go first, Springfield or Eugene?
Looks like Eugene. Chair Berger and members of the committee, my name is Christopher Henry. I'm the transportation planning engineer for the city of Eugene and an engineering graduate of Oregon State University, so it's refreshing to see the orange and black out here today. We at the City of Eugene and in partnership with the City of Springfield respectfully oppose Senate Bill 894 and similarly we favor Senate Bill 566, and we believe it more closely addresses our local concerns about freight route designation. It respects the process that ODOT has undertaken through the Freight Route Analysis Project to designate freight routes and freight mobility that we all agree is important through our communities throughout the state, and that movement of goods, commodities, services are important to our local economies. We, as the cities of Eugene and Springfield, through the Central Lane Metropolitan Planning Organization, have participated in the freight route analysis process and entered testimony in that regard, supporting the routes being proposed for designation. We oppose Senate Bill 894 and the Dash 2 and Dash 5 amendments as they propose arbitrary restrictions on height and width and use of the facility. Last time we testified last week, we had a discussion about highway capacity, and it seems like we've moved off of that area and the complexity of the definition of capacity. Now we're talking about height and width, and with it also comes a great deal of complexity about design. And in the friendly conversations with Bob Russell and the Oregon Trucking Association, we've talked about the difference between width or vertical clearance restrictions and design vehicles, and we haven't reached agreement in that regard yet. In the extreme, the proposed amendment would prohibit construction of a pedestrian overcrossing over some of these roadways, or conversion of a shoulder to a planter strip that could accommodate street trees and a sidewalk. Those are things that affect the height and the width clearances on these facilities. Such streets, the inclusive national highway system, were never considered for freight routes in this latest process with the freight route analysis project. We understand the concerns of the Oregon Trucking Association. We want to work to accommodate those vehicles. We believe that there are solutions through designating appropriate design vehicles, if necessary, to build our facilities to accommodate freight movement. But again, we oppose Senate Bill 894. And
would you mind repeat that last sentence that you just said? You're willing to designate certain vehicles and build up roads to accommodate that? Pass that by me one more time.
Yes, Chair. In the discussion with the Oregon Trucking Association, we've been trying to reach a compromise that we can both live with. Our preference from the outset is to use the existing process that's in place, the freight route analysis project through the Oregon Transportation Commission. Absent that, we're concerned about arbitrary restrictions on vertical clearance and width, which affect it all. And in its place would suggest identifying a design vehicle consistent with ASTRO design standards or those standards that ODOT would deem appropriate, which is most likely the same. And I do understand in the conversations with Bob Russell that there are exceptional vehicles that need to pass, and I think that's a discussion that needs to occur on a project-by-project basis as we move forward through design. Is 13.5 feet vehicle clearance enough for all cases? Maybe not. But to say no restriction on height, we don't feel is appropriate.
You also referred to the road, I believe. Something about the road that maybe I heard you wrong, but I thought it was something about reinforcement of the road. Something? No?
Well, it would be in the design and construction of improvements to the facility, and during the design process, we have to assume a design vehicle to adequately design the roadway.
Both,
and that implies the structural pavement design. If it's a bridge, it's load carrying capacity,
right.
Its height and lane width.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leonard Goodwin. I'm the Assistant Public Works Director for the City of Springfield. You do have written testimony before you. In the interest of time, I'd like to sort of abbreviate and go more directly to some of the issues. I can't really disagree strenuously with Mr. Russell's characterization of our conversations. We are certainly trying to find some way that we can both feel comfortable with whatever the legislature chooses to enact. I think that we still have some concern about whether or not loss of National Highway System designation would adversely affect our ability to secure certain federal funding in modernizing and upgrading these streets, so we're still looking into that possibility. If there's some way of making that work, certainly it's a discussion we want to continue. What we really want to see happen is some way of distinguishing between the essential functions of an NHS highway that is, as Mr. Russell says, in essence a city street, and one that is an inner city highway. We had proposed in my written testimony that you could consider perhaps applying this limitation on changing the height and width only outside of urban growth boundaries. That is, it would apply only to those roads where really the purpose was inner city movement, as opposed to those roads once you get into the urban growth boundary where you're trying to get from the highway, the inner city movement, into your distribution point where you can break bulk and redistribute to individual customers, or your pickup point, conversely going to the inner city system. That is one possibility we would suggest as an alternative if you wish to consider other methods to try to address the problem. Frankly, having just seen Senator Morissette's Dash 2 amendments this afternoon, on a very cursory reading, they seemed to address the problem completely by defining freight route in a way which is consistent with the freight route analysis project. That seems to really meet all of the city of Springfield's concerns, and absent something we find unusual in a more thorough reading of his proposed Dash 2 amendments, we would think that would be an appropriate way to move forward. And I again am prepared to answer questions.
All right, before I open it to other questions, I guess one of the things that the Dash 2 amendments in 566 may not address is the freight, that the increase of freight over the next years, a 15% increase. And so I think that they're trying not to lose capacity, which we can all understand that, but interstate commerce is very important to all of us, much less the commerce within our state as well. But you have to fight the ability to reach their goal along with the livability of your own communities. And I travel 6th and 7th Street, I do believe, because I go out 99 to Florence, right? So wouldn't that be my route right out there?
To get 11th Street, which is 126.
11th Street, yeah.
If you're going downtown, you're more than likely on 6 or 7.
Using 6 or 7.
Yes.
And so, well, other questions? Senator Whitsitt, do you have any? All right, Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Bricker. I'm the policy director at the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and also work with walking organizations to try and represent walking and biking issues. Really briefly, to readdress testimony from last time, I appreciate Mr. Russell's work to try and clarify the issues that we were concerned about, which were the capacity issues. And I'd like to note that I think where it seems like this is going is just as he stated, is to try and preserve the hole in the air for trucks. And in fact, I'd like to mention that throughway buses and RVs might have some similar dimensions, maybe perhaps a little bit smaller than some trucks, but other vehicles out there have some similar issues. And of course, we're in support of transit buses and whatnot. For us, as I'd mentioned earlier in my earlier testimony, the downtown or main streets and of communities in Oregon are really what we're most concerned about here. It's not the streets in between those areas, and in fact, in many of the streets in between, having a wide shoulder is good for bicycling and walking. However, in the downtown communities, many of the communities try and slow down traffic, to enhance the pedestrian environment, to allow businesses to develop along the frontage of those streets. And there are certain, I believe that this definition might be more constrictive than what we were hoping for. There might be an area that has a rural road that development fills in there, and then they want to put in sidewalks, and they want to put in an environment, and it could be a wide street. However, this might prohibit them from adding those sidewalks. There might be another community that chooses to add on street parking because business activity has increased, and this, again, would potentially prohibit that activity. As it goes for some of the removal of NHS designations, I understand from Metro staff there are some streets, including Highway 43, that they're hoping to remove from NHS designation. However, Highway 8, my understanding, will not be removed from that designation, and the City of Beaverton did submit a letter on concern of having that part of Highway 8 designated under some of these constraints. So I appreciate and hope to continue to work with Mr. Russell and the freight community. We have interest in making sure that all modes can use these streets, and particularly in the downtowns and main streets. And so I hope that we can do something through a design process and maybe refine some of this language a little bit. Thank you.
All right. Any questions from this guy? No. Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm going to have you stand back. One of the things that I'm faced with this afternoon is moving something that alleviates the concern of the McKenzie River people up 126 and the concerns of the entire northern part of my district and Senator Johnson's district. And at the same time, encouraging those who are in the Florence area and below that they will continue to have the capacity. So, Mr. Russell, come back again and let me talk to you a little bit, because this in no way indicates that I am not concerned about the increase in freight in the future and your ability to be able to keep your capacity. And so what I would like to suggest is that I have a work session, move 566 out, and continue to work with you so that we can get some of these cities. I see we have a letter from the City of Beaverton, and being a local person and a former mayor, this gets my attention, and it would be very difficult for me to not give them lots of time to work this out. But in no way does that show any lack of interest on my part in your serious issue as well. So,
Madam Chair, I'm perfectly comfortable with that.
All right. Thank you very, very much.
Madam Chair, if I could, I don't know if Mr. Russell knows, I don't know if copies of the stuff that we received is on the back, but there's also another letter that came in the packet today from the City of Oregon City. And so I'm not sure if you're familiar. It seems like some other cities are starting to weigh in.
Okay.
And so it might be something that we need to, I don't know if we need to bring the league in to try to make sure they get the comments in. I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, the league has been neutral on this bill up to this point.
Okay, so then it's going to be individual cities. I just want to make sure you know what we got in our packet.
Okay. Are there, Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, other than Beaverton and Oregon City, are there any others? I don't have the map in front of me. I know Beaverton is on the NHS. Highway 8 goes right through Beaverton.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Oregon City is...
They just submitted a letter that's dated today, and so I just want to make sure you're aware of what we know.
Okay. And we'll be happy to give you copies of that if you don't have them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 894. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill. Oh, we didn't post it. That's right. Judith is correcting me. We did not post it. So we will have to add that to our list when I see the president this week. And I believe, committee, that completes our work for today, and I will call the meeting adjourned.